The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Two professors teach wonderful classes here. One of us is currently teaching investment trading, human rights, and democracy. And Professor Robinson teaches foreign investment classes and specializes in financial issues and workers' rights. And has written a book on access labor side agreement. Lessons in the first 3 years. And a journal over a world standardized to help certify international workers' rights a practical alternative in the comparative labor policy journal. So I'll just leave it to that. Professor Robinson, start.
For those of you who listened to the debate tonight between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, you know that NAFTA has emerged as a central issue, particularly in industrial states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tuesday next week. Really, you cannot understand the debate in the United States over regular environmental issues, treaties, without understanding the background. And that background begins with that. So let me just outline for you the main elements in the alternative rule. Afterwards, it's about because it was actually proposed by the Mexicans in 1990. And up until then, Mexico had rejected any trade agreement with the United States between, because of the vast disparity and levels of barrier between the two countries. So what made Mexico change? Bukele, Salinas de Gortari, was elected president. And Mexico, therefore, deflected its commercial debt obligations in 1982, adopted the strategy of the world institutions and the U.S. Treasury, which came to be shortened somewhere else in the Washington Consensus, that verification of resources, reliance on permanent regards to the domestic economy. At the burden of economic development, a diminished role for the state in the direct production of goods and services and in the direction of the economy. However, that meant that Mexico was a radical change in strategy. Mexico would work more than a lot on state owned enterprises to stimulate the economy. And therefore, apparently, the measures Treasury, privatization of state-owned enterprises. They were not finished. The number of investment that they needed to substitute for the real estate money development. Now, anybody, Salinas and his finance minister, perhaps he went to Europe. And on Trump, they met with Thatcher, they met with Miller, and this was the grand crisis for the war, etc. And Richard and Thatcher told them that they granted all the reforms that Mexico was making to change from its import substitution industrialization to heavy reliance on the state. But there was no money for that. They were later on going to be Eastern Europe, and they were going to shift. There were directly banks and there were government resources Eastern Europe to consolidate the economies after the four for communism. And this was a great shock for science and acting. And it happened at that time that I was the instrument of Merrill Bank representative Berman, and president of the bank, Enrique Iglesias, was in Maryland and Paris at the time, and he wanted me to come over to Paris to meet with him to discuss where I was going and what he wanted me to do. And I was in the background waiting for him to come down from his meeting with Sylvia Sinastri. And he came down and he was very agitated. And myself and my colleague, who was a bank representative in Paris, we said, "What are you so upset about?" And he said that he just met with Sylvia Sinastri and they told him about their meetings with Thatcher and Mitterrand. And he said, Mexico is not a standard in the international economic system because of the reduction of all these reforms. And if this is the way that America can be treated, then America will the rest of us in Latin America. And so Salinas and Ashby came back from their trip to Europe convinced at this time the young government had stirred, that the world was going to be divided into three big blocks, by the Japanese, the European community, which was consolidated in the past kind of long-term currency, and the United States. So they never ran out of the United States. So then we first, after 1980, changed Mexico's policy. And they proposed to George Bush, Bush won. And he trade agreement with the United States. Which came as a shock to the Bush administration people who took an initiative to come about the business round table, which is the right thing to do for the multinational corporations, but about any expectation about any safety for the business constituents. But Salinas and Ashby concluded that in order to attract federal government investment in the magnitudes that are required to substitute for the government of the state in stimulating economic development, they have to work for something more than the traditional Mexican receptivity. So the NAFTA is as much about the incentives for foreign investment in Mexico as it is for traditional cross-border trade issues. Because they already had agriculture for Mexican exports and so forth, and after the dollar sector, the factories on the border, which transfer semi-finished products into finished products and then export to the United States under favorable tariffs and the world. So the traditional cross-border trade issues are less important for Mexico than the measures that are incorporated to attract foreign investment. So the NAFTA is the first treaty ever the WTO and the other programs, which has an explicit chapter on investment. And that chapter prohibited Mexico by treaty, but that was not treaty as far as the United States is concerned, it's an executive provision. Adopting policies which are traditionally held, limiting foreign investment, maximizing local content, limitations on ownership, modifying articles, requiring transfer of technology. All that is eliminated by platform level the investment chart. The investment chart sets up a parallel legal system for the resolution of disputes between the investor and the state. In the traditional trade agreement, the WTO, it's a state-to-state relationship. A private party wants to bring an action against the government. You have to convince your government on the ground of your claim so that it becomes a claim in the Carrara-Fucci case, which probably some of you have studied with Professor Ryan. The dispute between Carrara and Fucci turned into a dispute between the United States and Japan. That's for a NAFTA. In NAFTA, the investor has the right of initiating an action. The definition of extrapolation is the most ambitious. But I don't know anything about the U.S. and incorporated and incorporate second quarter cash. But another criteria, payment amount two, another thing that goes with these because I have more previous, they even have to be something more than direct and indirect. So, the investment chapter was designed to entice foreign direct investment to Mexico. And it is confirmed, in my view, the most important chapter from Mexico's point of view, more so than the trade, the cross-border trade issues, because they already have favorable trade for cross-border trade issues. Now, in the original map was negotiated by the Bush administration. They are around more labor and environmental provisions. Clinton, when he ran for president, he pushed for and he got trapped. And so they don't solve the idea. Then Bush would accuse him of being beholden to special interest, namely Bolivia, sacrificing U.S. national interest for the special labor union. On the other hand, if Putin agreed to support NAFTA, would drag a breach into an important Democratic constituency because labor was very much opposed, whereas they were very much opposed. And we all know that Clinton is the Houdini of American politics, and he is taking the track somehow, Bush, by saying, he will not endorse NAFTA as presently negotiated. Then he will not be negotiating NAFTA. He will not be negotiating NAFTA. Signed agreements on labor and the environment, which Labor Senator Buchanan at the time said would have teeth. Now, there is no legal bridge between the signed agreements in NAFTA and the main body of the agreement. So the discrete settlement provisions have a structure, but NAFTA does not come into play with respect to the settlement agreements, which are standalone agreements. And with respect to the labor agreement, I happen to have represented the Ecuador members of the Soviet Corporation, which was the first case that went through the labor signing agreement. It was 95% women, but tried to organize a union independent of affiliation with the National Confederation, which are really more, they're not unions as we understand them, but they're more instruments for the government to implement these. The inadequacy is of the little side agreement, at least with respect to enforcement, became very clear. There is no provision in the little side for any kind of enforcement action with respect to the hearings of the Association of Local Communities and Right to Strike, with respect to health and safety and minimum wage and child labor and other provisions, but they're so complicated. When the Mexican merchant was playing to the chief Mexican negotiator, he said, sorry, these provisions are so complicated that they'll never be able to be invoked. And in the case that I participated in, represented the workers, we got an excellent opinion from the U.S. National Administrative Office, which administered the NAFTA on the part of the United States and the Department of Labor. I was the written decision by myself. They said that the workers were fired because they tried to organize a union, that this was contrary to the intent and the provisions of the labor signing union and of Mexican law. And there was no remedy. The only remedy was consultation. And there's nothing but the finance consultation, they could sit down and have a bargaining tree. U.S. Secretary of Labor and the Mexican Minister of Labor, that would constitute consultation. So, none of them were found, none of them were reinstated. There's a blacklist among the Macro Duros, and they could not find a blacklist. the back of the girls. And I heard from Clergy Girls that it would be completely unethical to encourage any Mexican group to try and invoke the lead aside book. Because there was no remedy, and it just couldn't be so obvious. Now, you cannot overstate the degree to which American Labor Union leaders felt betrayed by the fact that there was no enforcement mechanisms in the side agreement, and there was no provision for linking the side agreement to the main agreement with its enforcement provisions. And you cannot understand the bitterness of the debate over trade and labor and environmental standards without understanding this background. And the conviction on the part of American Union people and their supporters in the Congress that they have been betrayed by the government. That ensured that from then on, the demands of labor and their supporters in the Congress and of the environmentalists were that the labor and environmental provisions have to be incorporated in the main government agreement. No one cited being assigned agreements around the enforcement. And the enforcement provisions have to be the same. Now, the first test was in 1997 when Clinton tried to get fast track authority. Fast track is a procedure by which the Congress agrees to put a law negotiated by the executive without amendment within defined time agreements. And they could not reach an agreement because of the existence of the Democrats and labor that any future trade agreement labor and the conditions. So they're not contrary to anybody's expectation. Because when you get back for the next 12 to 15 months, the assumption is that the executive can have the last 12 to 15. Don't really care about these, but they want a bridge or a community center or what have you. So the executive can always offer something. But this time that didn't happen. And Clinton did not get fast track. Apparently. Now we had the East Asia crisis of 1997-98, and the administration went to the Congress for additional funding for the IMF as part of the resolution of the crisis. And Bobby Frank, congressman from Massachusetts, Martin amendments which directed the U.S. executive directors of these international financial institutions to advocate overhead and ensure that the emphasis of the international institutions on labor market flexibility in particular, not on the labor market flexibility is a euphemism, making it easier to fire workers without being severance pay. The man on the ground, the core worker rights of labor associations. And to everyone's amazement, out of 12, in the background, trying to draft the amendments, they got to the American Congress. And I asked Frank, but how do you explain that you got these amendments through and fast track failed just at the beginning of the end? And he explained to me, he said, our politics had changed. But nobody realized when the Republicans regained control of the Congress in 94, but the tail point of the Republican Party had been resurrected. By the tail point, he meant the isolationist, which distracted any international leaders as an infringement on the other government. And so you had another alliance between the Democrats who didn't like or were not authorized because they didn't go back with the government, and this Republican Party of our flatboats who denied any international agreement because they were opposed to any international agreement under any circumstances. So the only reason I got through the amendment on international financial institutions was because of the urgency of the financial crisis. So when the Republican administration for sure proposed fast track authority in 2001, I think it was, they got the Treaty Protection Authority. The Bush and the business community realized
Presentation Laboratories like these tensions, it's important to get a sense of what is an issue, is the environmental movement concerned with the trade, generally speaking. There has been 15 years of debates on the climate trade. One concern is, of course, competitiveness. Countries failing to adopt environmental laws or effectively enforcement, it may gain an unwarranted comparative advantage of the trade. That would be one aspect for consideration. Another aspect of it concerns with the objective of the trade agreement per se. Trade agreements are intended to stimulate economic activity, to stimulate trade, stimulate investment, carbon direct investment. And as we know, economic activities have environmental impacts. How are those environmental impacts addressed, managed, mitigated? Are countries able to support, to withstand the environmental impact? Or are those environmental impacts diminishing the environmental that trade and economic activities intended to bring to the country? So this puts an emphasis on the institutional structures within countries to manage environmental impacts, the legal framework to ensure that increased economic activities does not derive in environmental harm. This is what is often known as the scaling effect. Increased trade and investment having environmental impacts and thus requires institutions to handle those. Changes in the composition of trade, regarding from comparative advantages, may also have a very environmental impact that needs to be managed. And a third aspect of the relationship with the regulatory effects, in particular with respect to the investment provisions that are included in this agreement since NAFTA, concerns the ability of the national governments to adopt internal rules and regulations for the protection of the environment that may in fact contradict standards of protection for investment. So expansive interpretations of indirect or expropriation would fall under this category of concerns. Bring no substantive rights offered to foreign investors international and internal investors is given a higher area of consideration. So now this environment, how does the Peruvian SFTA address this, these concerns into this presentation? Generally speaking, the background of this agreement cannot be understood without a reference to the U.S. General System of Frameworks. It's ATPDA, as you know, the preferences that arise in Indian countries were included, preferential market access to the U.S. Market. This preferential market access means that in many ways has access to the U.S. market for many of the products that it was interested in, but these preferences are renewed from time to time and can be revoked at any time because they're being left. They depend on the partners. So there is an interest in U.S. negotiating partners to be included in other countries as well. To get these preferences established in the real economic marketplace that has a predictable framework for doing business and investment in. So regarding the background, the work for the United States signed the agreement in April 2006. But then in June 2007, the United States concluded a program agreement. How did this happen? The only way that this can be understood is by reference to the changes that occurred in the U.S. Congress back in 2007. Since then, the environmental work has also been made presenting its interests and pushing the United States trade representatives to renegotiate certain aspects of the agreement in order for these interests to be reflected in the agreement in what is now current as the 10th agreement. So the USFTA contains an environmental chapter. This is not environmental free trade agreements. Post-NAFTA. When in fact, in fact, as Lewis Williamson said, is that mental dimensions of the parental provisions are included in the organism per se, not in the side that is disconnected. What does this chapter say? First of all, it encourages high levels of environmental protection. Second, it prohibits the weakening from using environmental laws to attract tribal enactment. What is the idea behind this? Well, the idea is in part that to increase the economic development and general welfare, deriving from that, will enable the society to achieve incremental levels of environmental protection. On the one hand, on the other, as I said before, when a country is reducing its level of environmental protection in order to attract trade and investment, the economic gains associated to that trade and investment will come at the expense of environmental harm, so which will reduce general harmful considerations and affects vulnerable communities. Third, it requires effective enforcement of environmental laws. In this regard, there is a difference between the labor and the environmental movement. So, the environmental movement can still be considered that. In general, we consider that the Mexico has the environmental law, generally speaking, but that the government has enforced it. So if there was an obligation to actually enforce your laws, then the situation could be addressed without intense interference with the national sovereignty that is associated with other countries telling the government that it's internal laws are inadequate. So this is what is now behind this organization. It ensures fair, equitable, and transparent proceedings for the administration and enforcement of transparency, government rights, and commentators as being cross-pollination in trade. We see the complete application of that in the administration of environmental laws, publication of laws, transparent proceedings. And in this regard, the Peru Alliance Environment Chapter also establishes mechanisms for public participation and access to information. These are also central elements in adequate environmental management, generally speaking. The participation of civil society, of local affected groups, generally needs to learn these issues to better more recent policy debates, greater acceptability of decisions, it contributes to implementation, plus there are high values associated with access to information, non-governance, and democracy are directly linked as the jurisprudence of also needs. Sixth, it establishes an environmental fairness council. Institutional mechanisms established in the UN to facilitate dialogue and cooperation between trading partners in order to address matters that concern the environment. Seventh, it establishes a citizen submissions mechanism. This is also a very important aspect of governance because it empowers civil society to present issues that may be of particular concern in a given country or in a given town. This environment is central for most in the government many times to take action. Governments usually respond better when there's public opinion or public pressure or mobilization, peaceful mobilization of affected citizens and disadvantaged citizens to present complaints to. Commission will review fully these complaints and come up with recommendations. It is normal and in light of the SI agreement on environmental cooperation, which establishes a similar mechanism for the Commission on environmental cooperation. Now Canada has heard several cases or complaints presented against three NAFTA countries. There is some discussion of whether these mechanisms are effective, whether they deliver outcomes But generally speaking, as I said before, it is a very important tool for environment and civil society, which is central to mobilizing and capturing the potential environment and capturing change. And finally, convince the governments to coordinate environmental activities pursuant to the Environmental Cooperation Agreement. This Environmental Cooperation Agreement is a separate agreement which contains activities that the parties jointly identify as having priority. A big challenge in this respect is adequate funding. Funding to carry out these activities. As we have international cooperation on environmental issues, transparent environmental issues in particular, is essential for effective outcomes. These formations, generally speaking, are in the legacy of future events coming from that and environment for several years afterwards. Associated to the American and Harrison trade deal. This was a deal struck in Congress, Republicans that was later to a further negotiation with USTR that introduced certain modifications to the agreement that was concluded in 2006, as we saw earlier. Finally, the environmental movement here in the United States participated actively in this process. So some of these norms or issues reflect the interests and positions of federal and environmental NGOs here in the United States. But the environment has become, according to most NGOs participating in the trade and environment debate, so there is still room for improvement. We may get to a discussion about the needs in the Q&A. In particular, as Professor Robinson mentioned, environmental regulations are subject to the same dispute settlement procedures and enforcement mechanisms as commercial regulations. Anyway, this is a sort of building that is international or international obligations. There is no such thing as civil obligations or criminal obligations. international obligation. So this is the way of characterizing the obligations included in the environmental chapter having an environmental dimension, which have been moved to. This mechanism is an instructor to developing effective deed to the environment. Earlier, a system of smart sanctions was in place in Chile, for example, the idea being, if a country is failing to enforce its laws, it is not because it is in bad governance or on grand terms, because it lacks the capacity to actually mobilize the resources for adequate. So instead of punishing a country by enforcing trade sanctions, which may have no negative effects on the economy and the environment ultimately, a better way of approaching this is focusing on the problem actually does exist, injecting resources on resource capacity or production capacity. Excuse me. So that's the idea. Our technician has proved effective. Its second very important change is that the provision on regulation has been changed from striving to ensure the structural characters were to share knowledge. The main drivers in the trade agreement also required parties to implement regulations and other measures to fulfill the list of multilateral environmental. This is unique. This is the first time that this has happened in a trade agreement. In this set of agreements, because it's not part of the time to be feasible to come up with a definition, I think this is something that we need to address. These agreements may have trade implications, so there is potential conflict between measures about to pursue these agreements you know, trade relations are important today. Need to be resolved in favor of both the NEA and in the latter in terms of its modification, which we have made on policy trade. The also contains analysis on five sector governance, again, unique experimentation given the particular circumstances of the group. Was the print on pictures put in there, the resources of the whole world. One of them on these slides, they are prepared by the Peruvian Ombudsman. It talks about illegal learning in Peru, Mahogany, Foundations of Science, CR, another slide, and we have another slide showing illegal learning of all the products. Some of the impacts of illegal learning, this is the PowerPoint presentation. Available to you given the lack of time, but it has much more than environmental implications. There are social implications, implications for the environment, and for indigenous communities, also implications for the economy. So, finally, what are some of the challenges of implementation? Where the field headquarters, where the U.S. Trade Representative will determine whether the oil program is implementing the agreement. Strengthening the institutional capacity in Peru to manage environmental impacts. The environmental ministry has been announced, and it's federal from the environmental cooperation agreement. And we'll leave it at that.
So how do you see with the debate there in Ohio, so they're concerned about wild draft, but actually the negotiation, if they negotiate not to include some of these provisions, do you think that's feasible to happen? Do you think they can actually insert these provisions as they are and use them instead of the signed agreements, which are not enforceable?
That they were going to reopen the negotiations, and there's the Mexicans, plenty of Mexicans, Canada sort, and if the Mexicans do not do that, that they were able to use the ARPNOW provisions on the map. Now, Hillary Clinton seems to have a better understanding than Barack Obama. Because she granted reference, it's a poor experiment, I'm sure it went over the heads of everybody. She made reference to eliminating grammar, making grammar language used, so that companies cannot bring suits in the United States, as happened in California when they enacted a provision, alleging that it amounted to exploitation of the power. What she was referring to is the investment channel, which allows companies to bring actions against states for, in this case, it was environmental, they brought the expropriation provision to the agreement, which was in conflict with the state of California's provision on prohibiting certain chemicals by this cabinet. I'm not sure that we may understand completely the investment channel. Indeed, in a prior negotiation, you had a bizarre situation where after having achieved really one of the objectives in the labor cycle, that is to say, holding ground instead of enforcing its own, whereas academic or the Supreme Court, they still came under attack. The NLCIR was the NLCIR was neutral, and the Democrats were negotiating this because they didn't address the investment chat. Your question about jobs, the issue in the investment chat is simply should you use the negotiating language of the United States government to negotiate provisions for the American companies to
as an encouragement to bank growth investing. The banking judicial system is notoriously corrupt. So, many companies say, well, we're going to go to Mexico because we know we're going to get justice in the Mexican courts. This independent tribunal has a parallel legal system that will try to overcome that objection. So, the attack from the left against the member, against the Peru trade agreement, that was the focus of the environmental labor provisions, which is approximately half of the sum of the labor Nixon. Maybe they have room for improvement, as he points out. But basically, in part of the environment, Peru takes us really to punching everything that people have been arguing for the last 15 years. The focus now is going to shift to an investment channel in terms of the incentive it creates to move jobs abroad. This wasn't even meant to get into a number of other issues. In the WTO, before China became a member of the WTO, the U.S. government negotiated with the Chinese government. It's a peculiar arrangement, but don't ask for a detailed explanation because it's crazy. The U.S. and the others were negotiating primarily with China before they become a member of the WTO. And the U.S. negotiation focused as much on the terms on which and subsidiaries and rather companies were going to be enabled to operate in China. And the U.S. negotiated for most value per tariffs. And last year, China, concerned about its various type of capitalism, leading to increasing income inequality, and therefore social and political unrest, decided that the right way to deal with this was to strengthen the unions and their voices in collective bargaining negotiations. And the very same subsidiaries which we have negotiated with the AI fund, these regular terms, then lobby the Chinese government against these modifications in its labor laws, to strengthen the labor laws. So our lack of currency is really incoherent. On the one hand, we say our labor laws are right. On the other hand, so we negotiated that trade with these subsidiaries of American-based multinational corporations that were in China on the most favorable terms possible. And all these companies are being next. The World Trade Center Association down in America, China proposes to strengthen those provisions. We have no idea of the incoherence of American policy and the international financial system. We don't have to be the last to take it on around. So, when we are faced with this, we don't have a coherent policy. And the Ohio discussion is focused on labor and power. So, they could introduce this question of the investment channel. But neither really has addressed the entire coherence of the government policy.
Thank you very much for your presentation, and I actually have the extra hour. Others probably didn't. I agree that we're just beginning to touch upon some fascinating issues, and it is too bad that we're wrapping up. But I guess I have a point that I was going as a question. There are two related points, so I just I don't tease out what the both of you are, I think, trying to say, with our own opinion, and you can maybe disagree how I said it. The first is on the environmental provisions that are in the program. I would agree that they are better than what we have seen before. I agree because they are in the agreement themselves, itself, and I agree because the provisions themselves appear to be stronger. But it's early. And I'm a little hard to be skeptical or so, but I would say that our really only difference is that all those sort of Mickey Mouse provisions are in the agreement. I'm still not sure that it comes down to like you can address the court. There's often a mandate of an injunction. Or anything you want to look like, I don't think we're there yet. And I think we're going to see that that language, while better, still has a lot to get at it in terms of our environmental protection. I think either good or bad, I think it just is. But the real problem in our federal investment, which I agree, Professor Robinson, is it has been brewing for a while, for a decade. This has been been going, Andrew. This isn't just a recent thing, right? You didn't come up with it, right? This is, it's reaching the apex again, but it's been building for a while. And what's good for the goose is good for the gander, sort of like a short way of saying it. And I think there's one thing to say: the multilateral corporations aren't really any private entity. Can have certain investment rights. I think we can probably agree about that. I think how those rights are enforced and where they're enforced is a totally separate issue. Just wondering in this classroom, understand it in that perspective. I don't think this is a sale, but I'm being right. You have the Arbitrum Act Chapter 11, and I think that is a great agreement. You can have multinational companies come into our country, either federal or state level, and attack those laws that were otherwise democratically passed. And the result will be that that level of government, whatever government that it is, will have to pay for that environmental regulation that is supposedly protecting the public interest. And I say supposedly because sometimes there are some gray areas as to what's competitive and what's protection. So that's why this investment, because it really is all about the money. It really is all about the activity goes in the environment. And it's sort of like a jack in the box. These trying to get a hold of bad behavior keeps finding new bugs to pop itself out. That's my take on that. We're making progress. We're far better in this decade than we were last decade. The debate has actually advanced. But I would agree there are levels of incoherence here. So I guess my question is, to both of you, have things really changed? I mean, really, with all this rhetoric aside, is the private grid that much better than the previous ones?
Well, just let me add one more thing. For our own interest, environmental issues. Frankly, it wasn't the government that came up with the left, frankly. Right. I think I have to see the program with respect to the neighborhoods of the Congress of the Coalition. What you started there, it was even controversial, and those who argued for the inclusion were acting as perfectionists. And now, the degree to which this is now incorporated in the agreement itself, core record rights instead of enforcing the own law, identical. So, from my point of view, I think they really have achieved a great deal. What you said is interesting. You see, apparently, attacking the environmental provisions here for the Bank of Reference agreements. That's exactly what I was referring to. Well, like I said, I don't think I understood it. But sometimes I have one more kind of seen a good kind of lawsuit and this international tribunal in Canada because there are enacted regulations for limiting the emission of this particular chemical. But this kind of company said that what happened to was tantamount to expropriation. What the hell is this? Where is this provision? So California found itself confronted with a possibility of a really clear liability, and it spent quite a bit of dollars in legal fees defending the case. So you know what? When early in the beginning of the discussion was, just let me finish. When we started out, when the European community and the Golden State Community, the United States accepted a common external tariff against American exports. In return, the U.S. exacted a commitment from the Golden State Community and later the European Community on national treatment for the subsidiaries of other corporations operating in Europe. But the corollary of that was that you accept the application. If you're going to be a national company, then you accept the application of local law and administer by local goods. Then, as the American investment gravitated to countries like the embassy of the U.S., to bring our legal systems, we insisted upon an international standard. That's what happened to Chile and the Allende. We rejected it because they had excess property provisions. Then, we've created a whole parallel ecosystem. So you have two systems. The NAFTA allows the defines expropriation of way. The NAFTA allows the defines the development of land as if you attack against domestic laws from the international agreement. That allows the local courts from the international tribunal. So you're probably right. We're at the beginning
discussion. Concern a range of issues.
Well,
then to leave you with this, that would get it. Because it's the very design of the brain is complete at this point, it's completely incoherent. That's where Harold Clinton's idea of a time now and taking a comprehensive view of whether or not they are just a Christian of incrementally added provisions makes a great deal of sense.
Let's look at what's happening in Peru. Last year, he has announced a series of measures to facilitate extraction of natural resources, privatizing the Amazon in order to secure legal rights, in order to facilitate investment in extractive industries. Were uninhabited and there were no indigenous peoples there. So this has the potential, of course, for a clash between investment and human rights direct clash. The dismantling of the environmental agency, CONAM, removing its personnel and changing it in the political activities, downgrading the indigenous peoples agency in the human department, in the announcing land exploration in protected areas, national parks, accusing environmental movement or environmental movement of terrorists, abusing laws against them in this regard. Is this our contributing to the environment in is the agreement going to be a tool that will enable safeguards against that kind of behavior? As you say, we'll have to wait and see whether the U.S. government takes a strong position and actually does evacuate this conduct in light of the commitments introduced. And there are examples of what's happening. We've written a comprehensive memo on this presented to the U.S. administration in order to facilitate this task. And then with respect to investment, this is, of course, a very controversial issue. Why should our people be deciding around democratically adopted practices, laws, regulations, etc.? The idea is, as Professor Hansen said, that there is a perception that the domestic judicial system in developing countries is inadequate, corrupt, or regulatory otherwise incapable of delivering effective justice. So we need a large systematic action. Objective adjudication in order to protect the interests of corporations doing business abroad, which will facilitate investment. Regardless that these arrangements need to increase investment, so that would be one point. Another is the idea that these arbitral tribunals are impartial, unbiased, and objective has also come under question because they conduct also the proceedings in secret. NAFTA has seen some developments in this area. This scheme of international governance is now about 2,500 bilateral investment treaties, which contain these kinds of provisions. So there cannot be an issue where they are more aware of the United Nations in secret. So these are measures of public interest that concern society in general. Second, the way that tribunals are appointed, where the investor can appoint a member of the tribunal. So how is the member for business naturally favors names that are favorable to interests. There is no mechanism for governor's decisions. This has been recently emphasized by a normal committee of exit in the CMS gas Argentina case. The decision of the tribunal committee did not change because it was the power. This is an issue of accountability. The legal system that has no way of correcting one of the decisions is thus unaccountable. This stands in opposition with democratic principles of judicial governance. And there's no one who can say that.